These are African rhythms, passed down to us through ancient spirits. Feel the spirit.
From WSNC 90.5 FM, a broadcasting service and NPR affiliate of Winston-Salem State University. Welcome to Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, anti-black violence in the African world, examining the continuities of violence in Brazil and in the black U.S. with Dr. Kristen Smith.
We have to recognize that we need to be paying attention to everywhere and every instance where black people are getting killed by the state and with impunity, because I think that that's something that's very resonant between Brazil and the United States.
Africa World Now Project is next. For Enrique Dussel, modernity dawned in 1492, and with it, the myth of a special kind of sacrificial violence, which eventually eclipsed whatever was non-European. For Walter Mignolo, 1492 is the moment at which there is a bifurcation of history. For Sylvia Winter, the 1492 event would set in motion the bringing together of separate branches of our human species within the framework of a single history that we all now live. And while it led to incredible techno, scientific, and other such dazzling achievements, as well as the material well-being of one restricted portion of humanity, it also led to the systematic, large-scale degradation and devalorization, even the extinction of a large majority of the peoples of the earth. Taking this idea further, Winter argues that the struggle of our new millennium will be one between the ongoing imperative of securing the well-being of our present ethnic class, i.e. Western bourgeois conceptualization of the human, man, which overrepresents itself as if it were the human itself, and that of securing the well-being and therefore the full cognitive and behavioral anatomy of the human species, itself, ourselves. Because of this overrepresentation, which is confined in the first part of the title as the coloniality of being, power, truth, freedom, any attempt to unsettle the coloniality of power will call for the unsettling of this overrepresentation as the second and now purely secular form of what Anibal Cujano identifies as the racism-ethnicism complex, whose basis the world of modernity was brought into existence from the 15th, 16th centuries onwards, and of what Walter Mignolo identifies as the foundational colonial difference on which the world of modernity was to institute itself, the ideas that birthed European expansion into the world, the human versus man conceptualization. The historical legacy and violent structures that are a vestige of racial mixing, albeit out of clear survival and necessity from the perspective of the Portuguese settler colonialists, and a lack of explicit apartheid laws, have allowed Brazilian elites to advance the myth of Brazil's racial democracy. Conversely, these same elites lament that the affirmative action and anti-discrimination policies, despite being upheld by the Brazilian Supreme Court, are U.S. imports bent on inciting racial distrust and violence. Though the fault lines between black and white are not as clear as they are in the U.S., the Brazilian police kill more than 2,000 people a year, and a majority of them are young, poor, and overwhelmingly black. Due to high rates of what witnesses and residents believe are extrajudicial killings, the police violence against the Afro-descendant poor black Brazilians is a genocide. While raw numbers indicate that police killings in Brazil far outnumbered those in the U.S., of the 990 killed by police in the U.S. in 2015, unarmed black men accounted for roughly 40% of the victims. When accounting for population, black folk in the U.S. are killed 7 times more likely than unarmed white men. Brazil and the U.S. police have much in common. Both are waging an intensified, militarized war on black, brown, and poor people that results in the reinscription of power relations that are in large part based on 14th century ideas of race, 18th and 19th century colonialism, chattel slavery, but all are quite frankly rooted in the false notion of white supremacy. In both the U.S. and Brazil, a culture of police impunity has led to high levels of distrust between police and predominantly black communities. With the U.S. having a clear historical link between the origins of the police as an appendage of the settler colonial state and its maintenance of order rooted in chattel slavery and the control of labor. What we will hear next is Africa World Now Project's Collective's associate producer Dr. Keisha Khan Perry and myself in conversation with Dr. Kristen Smith, Dr. Smith is a Black feminist anthropologist, social justice advocate, and associate professor of anthropology and African diaspora studies at the University of Texas at Austin, where her work focuses on the gender dimensions of anti-Black state violence and resistance in the Americas, particularly Brazil. Based on her long-term collaborations with Black organizers in Brazil, Kristen Smith's Afro Paradise, Blackness, Violence, and Performance in Brazil, published in 2016 by the University of Illinois Press, chronicles Black Brazilians' experience with police violence in Salvador, Bahia, and the dialectic between this violence and the state's construction of Bahia as an exotic space, an Afro Paradise. Using the lens of performance and performance theory, she examines the immediate and long-term impact of police violence on Black communities, particularly Black women and Black families. Today's program was executive produced by Dr. Keisha Khan Perry. And as always, in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descended communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corroboration Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all people. Enjoy the program.
Dr. Kristen Smith, Professor of African and African Diaspora Studies at the University of Texas at Austin, and author of the award-winning book Afro Paradise, Blackness, Violence, and Performance in Brazil, joins us today for an important conversation on Brazil, gendered anti-Black violence, and solidarity in the Black diaspora. Let me begin. Black Councilwoman Mariel Franco and her driver Anderson Gomez were executed on March 14th in Rio de Janeiro. In response to the murders, we were part of a group of U.S. Black feminists that included Kia Caldwell, Tiana Pichel, Wendy Mews, and Erica Williams that wrote the statement on the imperative of transnational solidarity, a U.S. Black feminist statement on the murder of Mariel Franco.
As Black feminist scholars from the United States whose work focuses on racism, sexism, and anti-Black violence in Brazil, we stand in solidarity with Black women and Black communities in Brazil who are mourning the politically motivated assassination of Mariela Franco. We recognize Mariela's death as a part of a larger pattern of state-sponsored killing, terrorization, and silencing of Black Brazilian communities. We know that she was killed because she identified and denounced anti-Black violence, particularly that tied to the current federally backed military occupation of Rio de Janeiro. We also know that she was not killed solely because of her race, gender, sexuality, class, or political beliefs, but because of all those things combined. Her death is an alarming, brazen political act of violence. Mariela was a Black woman who espoused Black feminism, denounced police violence, spoke out boldly and unabashedly about racism and classism, and fiercely defended and invested in her community. As such, she was a threat to the white supremacist, patriarchal, capitalist, imperialist, global social order. Her death is not a sign of the strength of this order, but rather it is a sign of its ever-expanding weakness.
As someone who has been going to Brazil for two decades and have deep personal, intellectual, and political connections in the country, what in fact has been the impact of Mariela's execution for you?
First, let me say thank you to both of you for having me on the program today. I really appreciate the invitation. I think that this is a particularly difficult juncture, not only in the history of Brazil, but also in the history of the global struggle for Black life. Marielle's death and assassination, I think, would be a more appropriate term. But Marielle's assassination was a real turning point in Brazil's recent history. The impeachment of Dilma Rousseff has brought on a new political turn where we've seen the kind of intensification of political violence and anti-Black violence in the country. And while for many of us who've been paying attention to the state's role in anti-Black violence, the death of Marielle is not anomalous, the fact that her death has garnered so much international attention is really important. And I think it's important for several reasons. I think the one that stands out the most is that it's bringing attention to the kind of anti-Black state violence that Brazil has been involved in for many generations. And although many of us have been aware of that violence, this is really the first death that has garnered this much international attention. And I think that that means that the world is starting to pay attention to what's going on in Brazil in a new way. And I'm hopeful that that also means that the many thousands of deaths that happen in Brazil every year are no longer going to go unnoticed and unremarked by most of the world. And so I think in many ways her death is not exceptional, but also something that very much is a turning point in the kind of global struggle against anti-Black state violence.
Why was it so important to make the statement, to speak out about the violence, and to make the connections between Brazilian anti-Black violence and U.S. anti-Black violence struggles?
I mean, I think that for many, many years, we have known that the kinds of violence that Black people are suffering at the hands of the police in Brazil is very similar and resonant with the kinds of violence that we are suffering here in the United States. And so, for example, in 2014, when Michael Brown was shot and killed in Ferguson, that same year, actually at that same time, I was participating in the March Against the Genocide of Black People in Salvador, Bahia, that was organized separate from and completely apart from what was happening in Ferguson. And so that was actually the second march against genocide in Brazil that was organized by the campaign Reaja Será Morto, Reaja Será Morto, React or Die. And there were marches across the country, and there were over 30,000 people who came out and marched against the police's use of lethal force against Black Brazilians. And so what I found interesting about that moment is that despite all of the resonances that were happening, there seemed to be this disconnect between the conversations that were happening in Ferguson and the conversations that we were having here in the United States and the conversations that were happening in Brazil, so much so that while people were talking about the kind of international dimensions of what was happening in Ferguson, nobody was talking about those international dimensions resonating with what was happening in Brazil at that very moment. What people were talking about was Palestine. And so in a lot of ways, that's what I meant by what I was talking about in terms of the Marielle's death being a turning point. In a lot of ways, this is really the first time that people are starting to really pay attention to the ways that Black death are resonating with Black death in the United States and globally in a different kind of tone. I think that it's not that everybody has been ignorant of it. I think there are a lot of people, particularly activists, and there have been lots of Black Lives Matter activists who have gone to Brazil and taken delegations and things like that. But the conversation has never been on a global scale, one that links these spaces together. And there's a need for that. And I truly believe that the statement that we authored together was really a call and a cry from people who have been doing this work for over 20 years to say, yes, it's wonderful that we're paying attention to the death of Marielle. Yes, it's wonderful that we are up in arms and we are crying out for justice in the face of her execution, but let's start to really think about the global implications of this. What does this mean for us as Black people transnationally? And what does that mean for our struggles transnationally? I think that that's something that the letter was intended to draw our attention to, and also to really tap into some of the conversations that have been happening behind closed doors but haven't necessarily come to the fore in terms of international media up until now.
That's an important point. And I know that you have written or thought about extensively about how even in the discussions around kind of Black Lives Matter impacting what's going on in Brazil, you yourself have made the claim extensively about how, no, there was an existing kind of anti-genocide struggle already taking place that activists in the United States could very much learn from. So I think that's really important. So I guess, you know, as an activist scholar who has written extensively about the issue of anti-Black violence and state violence in the diaspora, as well as organized struggle and grassroots movements around these issues, you know, what are some of the kind of maybe the issues that you would want the rest of the black world to know about what's going on in Brazil right now? So, yes, some folks have been paying attention, and maybe they've paid attention to what has happened with Marielle Franco. But why should blacks in the United States and the broader African diaspora pay more attention to Brazil and anti-racism struggles going on there right now?
Well, I think one of the things that I think is important to kind of emphasize is that, you know, we don't want this to be an either or conversation, mm-hmm. right? We have to recognize that we need to be paying attention to everywhere and every instance where black people are getting killed by the state and with impunity, because I think that that's something that's very resonant between Brazil and the United States, is that not only are the police killing black people and killing unarmed and armed black people. I think that the notion of unarmed black people just kind of draws away from the point that killing with impunity, killing without just cause, killing without due process is killing regardless. But one of the things that I think is important for us to really kind of recognize is that anytime there's a black death at the hands of the state, we should be paying attention. But it is particularly curious that we don't pay more attention to Brazil because of the disproportionality of the violence that's going on there. And so, for example, on average, we have, and these are, of course, statistics that have been critiqued and have been deconstructed, but I think it's something interesting to try to compare apples with apples, right? So let's talk about our official statistics here in the United States and the official statistics in Brazil. So here in the United States, according to the Washington Post, on average, there are about 1,000 people killed by the police every year. In Brazil, there are an average of about 4,000 people killed by the police every year. And so just in terms of numbers, we're talking about an exponential difference between the two. And we're also talking about situations that are very alarming. And so in the United States, we know that black people are disproportionately the victims of police lethality. In Brazil, the same is the case. I think in both cases, we don't have a full picture of the extent of the violence, primarily because we have no idea how many people the police are really killing, because these records are kept voluntarily. I think recent efforts by The Guardian and by The Washington Post to count black deaths at the hands of the, count all deaths at the hands of the police, in the United States approximate the numbers more accurately, primarily because they're looking at what is coming out in the media, what is being reported, and what's being circulated, as opposed to just what are the police reporting in terms of what, how many people they're killing. But in Brazil, these records are by and large kept voluntarily by police departments. And so the numbers are extremely skewed. And so if we recognize that the numbers are very skewed, and we're still talking about on average about 4,000 plus people every year, then we have a major crisis on our hands. And I think that human rights organizations around the world have really started to notice and talk about this as a human rights crisis. But recognizing that approximately anywhere between 70 and 90% of those killed by the police in Brazil are people of African descent. And the reason why I say 70 to 90% is that in addition to not having exact numbers, we also don't have exact demographic information about who's being killed, because that information about who's being killed is being voluntarily reported by the police. And so one of the things that activists are doing are trying to match up what the communities are saying with what the police reports are saying, and trying to figure out if we can get a more approximate understanding of what's going on based on that. But the fact of the matter is, we have a crisis of astronomical proportions that is disproportionately affecting black people, that is disproportionately affecting black communities. And one of the things that Marielle was killed for was talking about that, was really drawing attention to the fact that there's this crisis of police violence that's happening in communities like hers, like Mare, favelas, that are majority black, that are majority poor, where the state has come in and not only occupied and militarized these spaces, but also killing with impunity and killing at an astronomical scale. And so I feel like there's a way that, instead of thinking of the ways that we need to try to bring Brazil into the conversation about the fight or the struggle to preserve black life, we need to figure out how we can have, how it's even possible to have that conversation without talking about Brazil. Because if we recognize that Brazil has the second largest African descendant population outside of the country of Nigeria, then we recognize that to have a crisis of police violence in Brazil and to have it disproportionately affect black people means that this is a global crisis for all black people everywhere.
That's an important point, and especially I'd like to think about what that means for the murdering of specifically black women and a black queer woman who was murdered, right? So I think to make those connections in terms of who are leading kind of grassroots struggles and actually who are paying the price with their lives, I think is important to think about. Another question that I had was, you know, you're working in terms of your academic and political work with activists who are putting their lives on the front lines in the fight against anti-black genocide, right? Who are actually making these connections, kind of these national, international connections. So what are some of the conversations they're having in light of the execution of Marielle Franco and the increased kind of targeted surveillance and execution of activists and politicians? So what are they talking about, and what have you been kind of hearing amid those conversations?
Well, I think, you know, to answer the last question that you asked, I think that it's really striking and important for us to note that many activists have simply not been taken aback by Marielle's assassination, not because it's not devastating, not because it's not alarming, but because it's par for the course. Because it is so normal within the context of those who are constantly in the fight and the struggle to try to draw attention to the ways that the state is killing and killing at genocidal proportions black people in Brazil, that Marielle's death is one more in a list of many. And so I think that that's something that's been a sentiment that people have repeated over and over again. People are definitely mourning. People are definitely sad. But for those who have been in the struggle around this issue for a very long time, it's difficult to try to see the world note this death as exceptional. It's difficult to see people pay attention to her death and not having paid attention to the thousands and tens of thousands of others that have happened over the years. And so I think that that's something that people are trying to grapple with and figure out, what does this mean right now at this moment? Yes, we need to pay attention to this. Yes, we need to be in the streets. Yes, we need to call out for justice. But we also need to recognize the way that this is very much a part of the everyday and the everyday experience for black folk across Brazil, particularly working class black folk from favelas like Marielle's. Now, to the first part of your question, I think it's extremely important that we start to really pay attention to the unique ways that black women are affected by state violence. I think that one of the things that I've talked about repeatedly in my work is that when we only pay attention to deaths like the death of Marielle, an execution that happens that transparently links some sort of intended use of force by bullets that are associated with the police to a black woman's death, then it seems like black women are not victims as often, not the victims of these killings as often as black men. But when we think about the ways that activists and family members are killed slowly over time around the struggles that they're waging every day, then black women are very much the targets of state violence and state lethality on a regular basis. And so there are ways that the very anti-homophobic or the very homophobic and anti-black women, or misogynoir, to use the term that people are circulating right now, to think about the state violence in these terms, we have to think about Marielle's death and contextualize it within the broader range of deaths that are happening that are also affecting black women, and particularly black activists, and particularly black women who are queer. And so I can't help but remember the death of Luana Barbosa, who was beaten to death by police officers in the state of Sao Paulo in 2016. And part of the reason why she was beaten to death by the police in the state of Sao Paulo was because she was a masculine-presenting lesbian who, when the police approached her, they wanted to treat her like a man, and she insisted that she needed to be treated like a woman. And because of that, she was literally beaten to the point where she had a stroke. And so we have to start thinking about the ways that gender and sexuality and blackness is an intersectional matrix of violence, to use Patricia Hill Collins' term, affects the way that black women are impacted by state violence. And I think that these are things that the death of Marielle really does bring out, because I'm not sure that Marielle would have been killed in this way had she been somebody else. I think that this is something that was unique to her experience. And the fact that she was executed as she was leaving an event for black women's empowerment is just extremely, extremely devastating to those of us who call ourselves black feminists.
Right. And she was outwardly very out about being a lesbian, and that was an important part of her political platform. She had planned to get married. And I think a lot of, if you look at a lot of her speeches, you can see how important kind of questions around race and gender and black women's access to resources were, as well as the freedom of sexual expression and an openness to talk about trans and kind of non-binary gender categories. So I think in thinking about the kinds of even right-wing activism taking place in Brazil right now, she symbolized a kind of a very dangerous, you know, type of black woman. So it's not just any kind of black woman. She was very dangerous for a combination or, you know, referring to Patricia Hill Collins, kind of a matrix in some ways of identities that shaped her politics, right? So I think that's important. You yourself have written about, in going back to your thought about how state violence impacts black women in a variety of kind of ways that is not just about the bullet in a pool of blood or by the hands of the police. You've written about the death of Erica Garner and other black women in the United States and other instances of anti-black violence in the United States that makes those connections between Brazil and the United States, but certainly about the varied ways that black people experience state violence. Right. So I guess the question that I would have for you, unless James has another question, is, that's the last question I have, is, you know, what would a real kind of solidarity project look like around these questions of anti-black genocide, around these kind of questions around state violence that goes beyond police violence, that also really crosses borders in the African diaspora.
To be here in Brazil.
Então eu estou muitíssimo entusiasmada de estar aqui no Brasil.
Especially since I have followed recent developments in the Black Women's Movement.
Especialmente porque eu tenho acompanhado recentes situações que ocorreram dentro do movimento de mulheres negras.
And it seems to me that at this moment, Black women in Brazil represent the future of the planet.
E me parece que nesse momento contemporâneo as mulheres negras brasileiras representam o futuro do movimento.
Black women in Brazil have a very long history of leadership in the struggle for freedom.
As mulheres negras brasileiras têm uma história bastante longa em envolvimento em lutas em prol da liberdade.
As symbolized, for example, by the continuity of the Irmandade de Boa Morte.
Como tem sido
You are listening to Africa World Now Project on WSNC 90.5 FM, a broadcasting service of Winston-Salem State University and NPR affiliate. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, we are exploring the implications and the global connections of anti-Black violence and the African world, paying particular attention to violence in Afro-Brazil and its connections and continuities with violence in the U.S. Africa World Now Project Collective member and associate producer, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, and I are in conversation with Dr. Kristen Smith. Dr. Kristen Smith is a Black feminist anthropologist, social justice advocate, and associate professor of anthropology in African and African diaspora studies at the University of Texas at Austin. Her work focuses on the gendered dimensions of anti-Black state violence and resistance in the Americas, particularly Brazil. Based on her long-term collaborations with Black organizers in Brazil, Kristen Smith's Afro-Paradise, Blackness, Violence, and Performance in Brazil, published by the University of Illinois Press in 2016, chronicles Black Brazilians' experiences with police violence in Salvador, Bahia, and the dialectic between this violence and the state's construction of Bahia as an exotic space, an Afro-Paradise. Using the lens of performance and performance theory, she examines the immediate and long-term impact of police violence on Black communities, particularly on Black women and Black families. Our show was produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descended communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all people. Enjoy the rest of the program.
I think solidarity has to begin with an honest conversation about what the map of violence looks like for the Black community. And so, for example, I think that there are ways that police violence is much more than just the immediate death from bullets and baton blows and tasers. So when I wrote about the death of Erica Garner, I was really talking about the ways that her father's death precipitated the health conditions that literally killed her. And so we know that Black women, for example, die disproportionately as a result of maternal, of pregnancy-related disease. And she had just had a son. She had just had a baby. He was 4 months old when she had a heart attack, a massive heart attack, and was hospitalized on Christmas Eve. And so a woman in her 20s should not be having these issues. And so when we sit down and we think about, well, what are the things that are happening in her life that would have led her to have this kind of premature health condition? And one of the things that we have to take into account is the extreme stress that she was under and the extreme effects of the trauma and the depression that she was feeling because of her father's death and because of having to witness her father being killed over and over and over and over and over again on YouTube, on CNN, on all the different news programs. It was devastating to her, and she said so much in several interviews, particularly the last interview she did before she died. She talked about Vanita Browder, and Vanita Browder was the mother of Khalif Browder. Khalif Browder committed suicide after being unfairly incarcerated and put into solitary confinement and tortured for over 3 years in Rikers Island prison. And once he was released, he was never the same. He suffered from acute depression, killed himself, jumping out of his mother's window. And then just a few months after that, his mother died of a heart attack. But her friends and family say that she died of a broken heart. And I think Erica Garner died of a broken heart as well. And so when we think about Marielle, and we think about the death of Marielle, it's easy for us to make the connections between Marielle and the milieu of state violence that produces these kinds of moments. So we know that the bullets that killed Marielle were part of a lot of bullets that were purchased by the federal police. I think in about 2006, when that have since been linked to other massacres that were police authored massacres. And so there's enough contextual information within the death of Marielle that leads us to believe that this is quite possibly police related, right? And that's an easy connection to make, or an easier connection to make. It's more difficult for us to talk about the ways that black people are dying slowly from the trauma and the pain of racism, the trauma and pain of anti-blackness. And so what does it look like in terms of transnational solidarity for us to really start to think about what toll anti-blackness takes on our communities, on our families? And what does it look like to then heal in the aftermath of that? And so one of the things that I've been thinking about is that what does it look like to start healing circles? Like, what does it look like to really support people and actually get people the mental health services that they need in the aftermath of these tragedies, right? And what does that look like transnationally? What does it look like for us to really start to understand that what black people are feeling in Brazil is acutely linked to what black people are feeling in the United States, beyond the fact that the U.S. police are involved in training and exchange programs with Brazilian police officers. Beyond that, there's also just historical and social contextual information that makes us link these things together. And so I think that we need to start really truly embracing that and kind of moving away from this hyper-nationalist approach to how we understand violence in order to really truly build solidarity networks. And as with all things, black women and black feminism in particular have really given us a roadmap for how to do that, right? So from the Come By He River Collective statement to the work of Lelia Gonzalez, Ochi Curiel, there's all of these, there's so many black women who have talked about the ways that we need to try to think about our collective conditions in the Americas as one political experience. And so I think that we have to use those roadmaps and we have to use that political precedent in black feminism, in black women's solidarity, and black women's organizing. And I think from there we can begin to build a transnational solidarity movement.
Yes. I feel like this conversation is a very, very important. I feel like I'm a passenger in the back seat of this particular conversation, and really, really in awe of the critical and the breadth and depth of the analysis. What I wanted to ask, or as we end this conversation, I wanted to ask two things. I'm going to ask two questions, or have two ideas in this particular question. The first question is that I'm very, very interested, as a person who studies movements in a global context, specifically in the African world, who studies the Black radical tradition as a critique to the discourse and the theory and practice on human rights, I'm really interested in framing, specifically in Brazil, but in other diaspora communities, how they frame their resistance and their cause in genocide, which is something that black folk in the United States don't necessarily do, even though we have a history of it. 1955, we charged genocide that was submitted by William Patterson. I'm very interested in the framing of the issue, because there's also legal remedies, there's international law, there's international systems and tools that can be used to kind of get policy and different, not policy, but address these issues. And the second part of this particular question, as far as the framing is concerned, specifically the use of genocide, but also as a male, what can men do? You're talking about international solidarity. What is the role for men in this particular question? For me, I think right now, for me to sit back and listen to this conversation, but also support, this critical analysis and in any way possible. But for both of you, and this is also for Keisha Khan as well, the framing question is important. But also, if we're talking about international solidarity, what can men do?
Well, I think, you know, your first question about the Black radical tradition reminded me of the recent passing of Winnie Mandela, Mother Winnie Mandela, in South Africa, and really recognizing and honoring her legacy and honoring the kinds of impact that she's made historically and politically on what revolution looks like and what a revolutionary looks like and what does it mean to dedicate your life to the liberation of your people. I think that she personified that in so many ways, and really centered this issue of not only police violence and state violence in that struggle, because she was, I mean, because that was the focus of a lot of her resistance organizing. But also she focused on community. And I think that in many ways, the answer to your, my answer to your second question is that it you know, and I think about Francia Marquez. I know Keishakan Perry was at the Black Studies Conference that we had at UT Austin a couple of years ago, and we had the honor of having Francia Marquez, who is a very renowned Black activist from Colombia and the land rights activist from Colombia. And one of the things that we were talking about in terms of Black women's struggles and Black women's place in the movement, and one of the things that she emphasized is the need for us to remember and to recognize that these are community struggles. And so I think it's not a question of what is the role that men can take. The question is, how do we begin to foreground community? How do we begin to really radically reconceptualize our liberation struggles around the notion of community? And around that notion of community means that it has to be an anti-racist, anti-sexist, anti-patriarchal, anti-misogynist, anti-homophobic community, because otherwise it's not a community. And so as any member of that community, as a man, as a woman, as a child, as a non-gender binding person, anybody who wants to be a part of that community, wants to step up in order to fight for liberation, has to respect everybody who's in that community. And if folk are coming to it with respect and recognizing that the liberation of our people requires the liberation of all of our people, then anybody is part of that struggle, right? And so what the question then becomes is, how do we begin to check our privileges at the door so that we can be humble and recognize that we have to be able to negotiate and to compromise in order to be able to lift one another up and truly seek out the preservation of each of one another's lives. I think that's a really important point. And I think on the question of genocide, I mean, I think that's a question of semantics. And I think that one of the things I try not to get caught up in is the debate around the UN Charter on Genocide. And I try not to get caught up in that because I'm not convinced that the UN declaring whatever is happening in Brazil genocide is actually going to get us anywhere. I recognize that in many ways these international conversations around human rights are often ceremonious and don't necessarily end up in any particular measurable change. And so when I use the term genocide, I'm always drawing back on the 2005 manifesto that the organization that I've been working with since then, Reactor Die, Reactor Die, Reactor Die, started, and the way that they define genocide. And they define genocide as an attack, a comprehensive attack by the state on Black communities and on Black families and on Black religion and on Black life. And so for me, that's what genocide is. And I'm less concerned about Lemkin's definition, and I'm more concerned about how Black people are feeling and what kinds of terms are we using to talk about the kinds of struggles that we're doing. And I think that there was a time when folk were completely rejecting. Back in 2005, when Heyaja was using the term genocide, nobody wanted to talk about it. Nobody was talking about it. And then all of a sudden, even the Brazilian state is using the term genocide to talk about the crisis of anti-Black violence. And so there are ways that our terms can often be co-opted by the powers that be, and we have to be careful and not be invested in them. And so that would be my answer to your second question.
I mean, I've thought a lot about these particular questions, which are great, and I think Kristen Smith has already provided all the right answers, I think. But I just wanted to add and say that even among Black feminists who have written in the United States and abroad, their main concern has always been about community. I mean, these are Black women raising Black sons who want their children to be invested in a much more egalitarian society that takes into account gender equity and equality, and that their children not reproduce patriarchy, including their Black sons. So I think that for me, the role of men in any sort of even transnational movement is one, means that if you are invested in Black liberation, it means that you're invested in Black liberation in terms of all Black people, right? So I think that I don't see how, for example, men would not be concerned with the murder or the violence against Black women, right? If you're truly committed and concerned with a Black liberation movement. And I think even the movement in the United States around hashtag say her name, the question that they're asking is, what is the investment in saying in the focus on black men, right? The focus on black men does not encompass the extent of the violence that we are experiencing as a community. And it's and the state itself has reproduced this investment in the discourse around the violence is killing black men, the violence is killing black men. And I think what Kristen Smith said about the various ways that we're experiencing state violence beyond the bullet, beyond the gun, I think the barrel of the gun, I think it's important to really acknowledge that, because it really, taking it beyond the barrel of the gun or the bullet, really allows us to see how black communities are being strangled or being eliminated by various kinds of violence that are profoundly interconnected, right? So I think men who are committed to the liberation of black communities, to a certain kind of, or a particular kind of humanity, I think would see these issues as their own, right? So I think that's how I would answer that question.
And I just want to add something really quickly. I think that it's important to note that your work in particular, Keish Khan, has been really fundamental in kind of shaping my understanding of the ways that community and gender factor into the kinds of solidarity struggles that we need to be building. And I think particularly your work around land rights is really quite groundbreaking and must be mentioned within this context. And I think the last thing that I will say is this, in our statement that we did for the Black Scholar, we ended towards the end of the statement with a quote from the Combahee River Collective. And I think that quote is really something that summarizes the ways that this question of black men, black women, and gender and the struggle come together. And that quote is the following: if black women were free, it would mean that everyone else would have to be free, since our freedom would necessitate the destruction of all the systems of oppression. And I think that that's really what it summarizes how black feminism approaches this question of gender and solidarity. It's not that we think that we are the only ones that need to be free, but we recognize that if we solve all of our problems, then we're going to solve everybody else's problems on the way there.
That's a wonderful way to end our conversation today, Dr. Kristen Smith. I believe that all of us should probably go back and reread the Combahee River Collective statement that profoundly shaped our own statement around the assassination of Marielle Franco. But certainly it speaks to a certain kind of anti-racism politics that we all need to pay more attention to. So on that note, I'd like to end our conversation by thanking you and Professor Polk.
Thank you to both of you as well.
That's it for Africa World Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email africaworldnowproject@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist, Moise Mutale, Africa World Now Project media correspondent, Funda Ngunda, senior research, content contributor, and production director, Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior researcher and content contributor and production associate, Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, technology advisor is Byron Gray of GrayWorks Technology, and creative director is Judah Pope. Africa World Now Project is heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC NPR affiliate and broadcasting service of Winston-Salem State University. Shows are archived weekly on SoundCloud. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent.